Hello everyone and welcome to the History of England. Today I have a special treat for you, an interview with a man called Stephen Milesome, who is a historian for the lovely Victoria County History and a landscape historian to boot. I happened to meet Stephen when he took a module on an English social and local history course that I did and instead, and in fact, which I'm still doing, which is incidentally why I started inflicting so much social history on you all, because I'd been loving the course. And Stephen's module was fantastic. And at the time, Stephen, I think you and Stuart Brooke were working on a project, the subject of which we're going to talk a bit about today, and from which you are publishing a book very shortly. I think you also asked us for title ideas, and we weren't very good at that. So anyway, hello, Stephen, and welcome to the History of England.
Hi, David. Thanks very much for having me on.
And unless we forget to tell everybody, the title of your new book is Pleasant Perceptions of Landscape, South Oxfordshire, 500 to 1650. So, Stephen, could I ask you to tell everybody about yourself? And then maybe we can talk about what are you trying to achieve with the book. That's about four questions. I said I wasn't a great interviewer.
Thanks, David. Yeah, so, I mean, I've spent years now as a landscape historian doing a lot of the traditional things that landscape historians do that are really important, like, you know, trying to reconstruct the landscape and its development over time to see what that might tell us about the people who actually lived in it. And I've written other things. I've written about deer parks, which sounds pretty obscure, doesn't it? Medieval deer parks as a way of kind of getting at aristocratic culture, understand why these nobles were so mad keen to chase deer around and slaughter them in these large hunting reserves that they set up. And that kind of started to shed a bit of light on aristocrats. But of course, aristocrats are kind of quite well documented, aren't they, even in the Middle Ages. But I'm not really a kind of king and great men kind of historian. So I wanted to get at ordinary people, you know, peasants, if you like, in the countryside. And that's why I took a break for 4 years, terrible for my pension, from the Victoria County History, and set up a project, my own research project with Stuart Brooks at Oxford, to look at peasant perceptions of landscape. And we set about kind of exploring the area you live, really, which is South Oxfordshire, you know, an area about, what was it, 15, 18 miles south of Oxford?
Yeah.
Which is kind of well documented and rich in archaeology and near enough for me to get in the car and visit. And that's how the project started, really, of a sort of a crazy idea that we could actually get at how ordinary people understood the world around them.
And what were you trying to achieve with the book? Because it's quite a hard task, I think you set yourself, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, look, in our sort of urban society, largely of the 21st century, you know, we can all, I guess, understand how we appreciate what we see as, you know, rugged or wild landscapes, you know, normally experienced with lots of modern conveniences, and not really have much of an eye for sort of, I don't know, the productive potential of an arable field or something. But before industrialization and before the kind of romantic movement, things must have been different, mustn't they? Most people, 90% of the population earn their livelihood from the land, from their little tiny farms, and their livelihoods and even their lives at some points depended on making the most of their few strips of arable land or their sort of stint on the common.
Yes, I was interested recently actually to learn, sorry I'm interrupting, to learn that in the primary school, local primary school, one of the things the children did in the 19th century was learn religiously all the different field names.
Okay.
And I thought that was a really interesting example of how our focus has changed, because nobody knows what the field names are now. I spoke to the local farmer and he said, oh yeah, we've got field names here. There's field one, field two.
Arable one, block nine.
So anyway, sorry, carry on, I interrupted.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, we kind of can imagine that things were different because it was much more practically important to know every kind of nook and cranny of the landscape. But we also know that, you know, these peasants were living in a world imbued with religion and kind of magic, and it wasn't all pragmatism, that sort of folklore was bound up in the local landscape and religious ideas. So I wanted to kind of put that all together and get a kind of peasant's eye view of the landscape. But also, to get a sense of change, you know, because as historians, we're always interested in change and realizing that things aren't kind of static, but, you know, big stuff happens, like the formation of villages in the Anglo-Saxon period and open fields or the Black Death and, you know, half the population's dead, you know, these kind of things must have a big impact on how people use the land, how they make their living, the way they understand kind of the world around them. I mean, those kind of school children, I suppose they were already kind of collecting fragments of the past, weren't they, in the Victorian, Edwardian period. And we're all interested in like sense of place, aren't we, these days, and how we engage with our, you know, local community and how that's more meaningful if there's a sense of place. But I wanted to kind of get to that hundreds of years ago.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more. One of the reasons, you know, as you know, we're writing a little local history at Swinkham is to encourage that. I think people are very important as everything else moves so quickly and is so global. They're interested in finding where they came from and what the world around them, how it came to be as it is.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even thinking about that, of course, peasants, they weren't living in kind of closed villages. They were open to outside influences, even in the Anglo-Saxon period, even the 12th, 13th century. And I think that affects their perceptions differently across different areas. You know, some places are better connected than others, have more kind of outside influences. So that's an interesting thing to pursue because, you know, I said I like peasants, but of course, kings and bishops and so on, they matter, don't they? And they introduce things like Christianization or the local church, and that also shapes how people think.
Yes, that's really interesting because, again, here in Swinkham, it was, as you know better than I, it was the Abbey of Bec that held the manor until the Hundred Years' War. And then in 1404, they kick out the Bec Abbey because, of course, they're sending their money back to France or so on. And so you get a complete change of land ownership, which is secular and, a very different approach. So all those big things of Edward III trying to make himself king of France has an impact on people living in Swinkham.
Definitely. I mean, you see just next door to you in Nuffield, there's a medieval field named Calais.
I saw that, yeah. I thought it was great. A nice little quote that they got the two mixed up.
Yeah, and it seems to come from this close engagement with France, knowledge of the English garrison at Calais, that it's distant places start to be called things like Calais. It's the edge of the village's fields. Like later you've got in Ewelm, it's also near you, you've got an America field, you know, these sort of whimsical names for places on the edges.
Yeah.
And I think they had some of those in the Middle Ages too.
It works the other way, of course, that the Rutkeens, I think a member of the Rutkeens moved to New Zealand, and the estate there is called Swinkham.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, what these personal identities, we impose them on the landscape, don't we?
Yeah.
We're not kind of, how much are we bound up with it? How much does it shape us? Or how much do we kind of shape its associations, drawing on outside ideas or different kinds of ideas? Because, I mean, you see in the Middle Ages, people's identities are quite bound up with the village. Sometimes they're even named after features in the village, you know, John of the Well or Alice of the Pond. On the other hand, they kind of bring to bear outside ideas and their identities are not purely kind of territorial, if you like. So, of course, people have family affiliations. They have by names, you know, they're sort of, before we had these hereditary surnames, we have these sort of descriptive by names, which could be very rude,
but right, is that
quite
right?
Amusing, about personal characteristics, which we won't go into. But, you know, a lot of them relate to family. You know, that matters, that inheritance or that job that you do. There's a wonderful by name. This chap called the Candlemaker, Le Chandler, Robert Le Chandler.
Right.
He's got a little wax seal showing him holding up a flaming candle. You know, it's probably a sort of like a business calling card. So it's not all about the land. You know, even then people are a bit detached from the landscape. There's a sort of a human world within it, if you like.
Yeah. So the peasant voice, of course, is traditionally very hard to find. As you say, it's namely the aristocrats and so on that leave a record. So what sources did you use to try and hear the peasant voice?
Now, that's a really good question, because a lot of historians kind of think it's impossible to get at what peasants think or thought. You know, there's Michael Clancy, a very great historian who wrote a very important book about literacy, said that kind of peasant mentality is out of our grasp, really, because they didn't, you know, leave any diaries or memoirs. And to an extent, you know, he's right. On the other hand, there are bits and bobs of evidence that you can very carefully tease out. And we know that in very rare circumstances, like there's a place in the Pyrenees, much more romantic landscape than South Oxfordshire, that famous French historian Emmanuel Leroy Ladurie wrote about in his book called Montaillou. Yeah. And there we know what the peasants did and what they thought, because all these nasty inquisitors spent a long time trying to tease it out of them. And we know how they sat on the doorstep selling themselves, how they swapped gossip, you know, bits about their sex lives, in a way that we don't know about peasants in South Oxfordshire.
I don't think we have sex lives in South Oxfordshire.
As good local knowledge. What there is are names. And names tell us so much about people's understandings of each other and the world. I mentioned those by names, the way that peasants are actually named after the landscape sometimes. And you can tease out patterns there between different settlements, how that varies, you know, between the vale, the flat open vale. We haven't really talked about this much yet, the differences in geography in the area, the vale part and the wooded Chiltern part. But particularly these field names, which we have mentioned, which give us kind of, and they must be kind of coined by peasants, I think, because they show this really intimate local knowledge of the landscape that lords, you know, often didn't have. They have my own 20 manors and they hardly ever come to a certain place. And in fact, we occasionally have direct evidence that place names are given by peasants, even the names of villages. So Cooksum right. in South Oxfordshire is a lovely example. There's a charter boundary, a sort of description of the estate when it was granted as early as 995, so a very early document. And in the charter itself, it describes this place as the place the country people call Cuchesham. So it's the country people, and Cuchesham is Cook's hemmed in land or meadow. And if you've ever been to Cooksum, it's a tiny place. It's made quite famous by Paul Harvey's book within the sort of geeky historians world. But if you go there's a nice pub, you see that it is a tiny village kind of hemmed in by hills. So that description still more than 1,000 years later is very suitable. So we can yeah. see how these names yield something of peasants' perceptions. And we spent a long, long, long time collecting hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these names, trying to see how they changed over time, mapping them in the landscape to see if we could actually identify the real features on the ground and go and look at them and look at the views between different areas. So that was the way, really, that we got at it, not by coming across some lucky source like a peasant diary, or wouldn't that be wonderful, but just spending a long time teasing out meaning, really, if you like, from the documents and then examining those in the real landscape. We did some more wacky stuff too, like ringing church bells and running off, seeing how
they... Oh, I saw that. Yeah.
You know, we know that churches are kind of centers of belonging and meaning, but what happens when you get beyond the bells' audibility and you can't hear the bell in your hamlet? Does that affect how you know, interact with the church?
There was a lovely record I came across in Rotherfield Grays, obviously, which isn't far away, about the vicar despairing that nobody ever came to church, and he rang and rang and rang the bell, and yet nobody came. And that, I suppose that's because it's a very dispersed...
Yeah, absolutely. Either he was a good sort of... He may come up with a good excuse, but actually, if you go to Rotherfield Grays, or if you look at an old map and see how many houses were around the church, you know, there isn't a village as we would probably normally understand it there. This Chilterns part of the Hundred, obviously, for those that don't know, it's this big range of clay-capped chalk hills, which stretches all the way from sort of the Goring Gap on the edge of the Berkshire Downs way up to Hitchin in Hertfordshire. It's quite a major feature in the southern English landscape. And in its southern part, you've got all these now beech woods. I think they used to be much more mixed with oak and other species, but very, very wooded landscape of broken topography and very scattered settlements. So places like Rotherfield Grays and the places I looked at in the book, you don't have the classic kind of nucleated villages. And I think that did shape how people interacted. It wasn't everything, but it did have a strong impact.
Yes, I was really interested by that, and I'll probably come back to that. So you chose South Oxfordshire for that reason, did you?
Yeah. So, I mean, one reason was that it's richly documented because it's near Oxford. I joked about jumping in the car. That was important too, to actually go and get to know it really well and not be one of those historians who just sort of sits in the study. but also because Oxford colleges happen to have bought up a lot of estates in the area in the late Middle Ages. And of course, they're perpetual institutions in a way that lay landowners, you know, aren't. And so they've kept all their records. They've got all these musty records in Oxford College towers and chests that we can actually go and look at. Lots of early maps as well, which are really, really helpful. Maps from as early as the 16th century, you know, of these landscapes. But also, it's on this, it's on the cusp of one of England's great landscape divisions. So it sits on the very, very edge of what these historical geographers called Roberts and Rathmell called the Central Province, which is a sort of middle part of England from sort of Northumberland down to Dorset, in which there are historically more kind of clustered settlements, or nucleated settlements is the jargon, you know, the tightly knit villages with big open fields around them. And in these open fields in the Middle Ages, people collaborated really closely over cropping, over sowing crops. People had these little strips of land, and within each field, it wasn't enclosed, and they had to kind of get on with their neighbours very closely and organise, you know, when you'd sow, when you'd harvest, when you could put animals on the stubble without them eating all the other crops. So part of the study area is like that, is on the edge of that. The area around Benson, which is probably best known now for its airfield, up to Great Haseley, which is across the M40 motorway, where you really see this Vale-Chiltern divide. If anyone's driven up the M40 towards London from Oxford, you know, you come to this kind of wall, which is the scarp of the hills, and you drive through this chalk-sided kind of entry to the Chilterns that was, of course, blasted out in the early 70s with dynamite or whatever.
Metroland.
And the rest of the study area, the southern part, is this wood pasture landscape of kind of scattered settlements from a very early period without these big open fields. They seem to have had a few little ones, but not the big open one, big open ones. And they must have collaborated in different ways. They still had to do some stuff together. They still had to organise, say, grazing the commons, which they had, but they didn't. You know, if they were, say, cutting wood, that was something you might do from your isolated farm kind of on your own or with your family, not with all your neighbours, in the same way as you'd get all the neighbours together to gather the hay, you know, in the Vale from the riverside meadows. You'd have to get everyone together in a short period before it's all spoilt by rain. And they don't have surface water in the Chilterns, really. Mm. You know, have you got any streams in Swincombe? You haven't really, have you?
No, not at all. It's interesting. I was talking to a friend who's got a little house with a cistern.
Right.
In the back.
Yeah.
An old cistern, because until the 1930s, there was no running water here.
Absolutely.
And there were no streams. So,
So it makes life different, I think. You know, there's still share. I think these settlements, they had a different amount of kind of public spaces, if you like. And that's one of the things I developed in the book as a tool for kind of getting at perceptions, thinking about more open or public and more private or closed or private kind of spaces. And in the Vale, obviously, you've got these big open fields which are shared. They're not completely public because, you know, Joe Bloggs couldn't come from 100 miles away and start taking the crops. You have to have a share in the field system. And you've got some buildings which are public, like the church or the nave of the church. And the highway, and people invest in these public spaces. You know, villagers invest in the church. They invest in stepping stones and bridges over these streets that were flooded in the Vale. The Vale's really wet. It's quite wretched still in the winter, isn't it? Sometimes all that clay. So you had to, you work together to keep these things running. And the big Vale villages had more of these shares. They had, you know, big churches rather than the tiny chapel or no chapel at all. They had lots of craftsmen, maybe an inn even by the late Middle Ages. Whereas the little Vale hamlets didn't really have as many public spaces, and certainly the Chiltern wood pasture settlements didn't have them in the same way. And it seemed to me that that affected people's day-to-day interactions. You know, they all tried to keep their houses quite private, if you like, these medieval houses, we should imagine, this sort of low, kind of smoky, quite small, timber-framed and thatched roof buildings with kind of smoke percolating through the roof with no chimneys. But they peasants went to great lengths to keep them private. They kind of put big fences round and gates and thorn hedges. And if you came eavesdropping at the house, you'd be reported in the manor court. You know? So they wanted to keep up appearances, if you like, by keeping their private business private. So we know that they had more closed and more open spaces. And therefore, the differences in the amounts of those spaces tells you something, I think, about people's interactions. And also, when you look at the field names, for instance, that suggest kind of shared folk stories, Mm-hmm. More of those seem to be in the big Vale villages than in the little hamlets or the Chilterns. It seems there's more scope maybe for people gathering together and, you know, discussing these stories and developing them.
I mean, I was very interested that in up here you were saying that one of the only social spaces really were the roads.
That, yeah, yeah.
Outside of that, there weren't structures in the same way.
No, so I mean, you know, the trouble with Britain, of course, is it rains a lot, doesn't it? So you can you can be in the street.
Well, we should be grateful for that, Steve. Yeah. Never too hot, never too cold.
There's a wonderful one of these by names I talked about. There was a bloke called Robert Stand in the Street. In the
right.
I guess he spent a long time chatting to his neighbours, so long that he got that nickname. He lived in the Vale, you know, where he had lots of neighbours. In the Chilterns, you know, these little scattered hamlets, you might have three or four people around a green,
right,
but no more. And also, I think the houses, they're oriented differently. So they're sort of higgledy-piggledy around greens. Yeah. I don't know if yours is higgledy-piggledy, but yeah, it probably is. But in the Vale, you've got these rows of houses. Everything's very regular with this sort of broadside orientation. So people step straight onto this public space of the street, or at least the kind of middling folk do. You know, the rich guys, the free tenants, tend to live at the edge of the village in these bigger houses set back from the road. And again, I think that even something we might not think about at all, like the orientation of houses, can actually shed light on the way people interact with that more public space of the street from within their own homes. And that, again, that changes over time in the period.
Presumably up in where I live then, what we're talking about, I might be called Roger, don't bug me, rather than Roger Stand in the Street.
Yeah, if anybody knew your name at all, no.
Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, I think, of course, they have communities, they have a church, you know, they still invest in the church. They still have to do things like gather tax. So there is, I think, a village community. Yeah. They have to regulate the commons the way someone doesn't overgraze the commons with too many cows. But they don't engage so regularly as people in the Vale, I think, in such an intense fashion.
So how does that affect the mentality and sense of identity, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very critical question. And I think, you know, historians have tended to sort of sweep this away, that across England, you know, communities are somehow created from the outside, that kings demand tax, the church demands you mend the church. So it's the same everywhere. But actually, I think not. I think there's a variation in how tight the nature of these. I wouldn't like to say that they're a sort of stronger community in the Vale, because it's very much a community dominated by the well-off, isn't it? It's the bossy big tenants that are kind of shaping it more than the cottagers or the landless labourers. But the quality, the nature of community, I think does vary a bit across those landscape types. Now, I've forgotten the question you asked.
You were answering the question. I was remembering David Underdown's famous proposition around chalk and cheese lands, the people were actually given their landscape had a different outlook and attitude towards life. But in your book here, I don't think you concluded that although there might be a different mindset, I think you suggested that the identity was not that I'm living in the Vale or I am living in the hills or either one. That didn't seem to be a defining identity.
No, I think that depends on the period a bit. And Underdown, by the way, is a really good example, because some sort of early modernists have claimed that landscape matters, you know, economic difference, like, you know, clearly open field, what they call champagne landscapes compared to the sort of the dairying in other areas. But they didn't really develop it or kind of prove it, really. And I think looking at this very long period has been useful, because you see early on signs that, you know, there's a whole bunch of people called the Chiltern Setters, which is a wonderful shadowy group in the Anglo-Saxon period. So I guess that then their identity is bound up with the Chilterns being a different resource patch, if you like. But later on, you're absolutely right. It's an astute reading of the book. I'm glad someone could see the argument somewhere in it. But you know, I think maybe another high point is the sort of 12th century, when the difference between Vale and Chilterns is quite marked, because the outside influences, the early stirrings of commercialization are more in the Vale, the well-connected Vale, than they are in the hills. And of course, the River Thames, we haven't mentioned, which runs through the area, kind of connects it, and the market towns as well. But now, overall, these people share the same kind of market towns. They trudge all the way up to Wallingford or down to Henley from the Vale. Yeah. And you don't get, maybe it's because it's not a big enough difference. I guess if you've got mountain folk and, you know, salt marsh folk, they have a different identity. But within this area, they behave a bit differently. They have different ways of identifying each other. But no, there's no really strong sense of I'm a Chiltern man kind of thing.
Yeah. I was very interested about the subject of transhumans, about people moving from the Vale up to the hills. And you seem to suggest that there was a very definite route from the Vale to the hills to use the resources in the hills, but that was less evident the later you got.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there are these special sort of broad grassy pathways called Fieldon ways, which are mentioned in the Anglo-Saxon charters, which follow sort of ridge lines from the Vale up into the Chiltern. So clearly people were grazing their animals in the hills because there was probably, you know, the Vale was getting more densely populated and there was less pasture. But that's only to a degree, because the Vale's got lots of claggy, wet kind of places that you can use as pastures that you can't really cultivate as arable. And by later in the period, the kind of commercialization breaks down some of these differences between Vale and Chiltern. So everyone is kind of, you know, they're still feeding themselves, but they're all selling to market and the same kind of markets. And I guess from the sort of 15th century, when you've got this massive population decline, because I mean, remember that the population in the 15th century is probably about the same as it had been at Doomsday, you know, hundreds of years earlier. There's space for everyone to do more grazing, and people are enclosing, or a few people are enclosing some of the open fields in the Vale so they can have more cattle and sheep, particularly sheep. You know, this sort of sheep are eating up men.
So
that difference, that kind of link becomes less significant, and the big farmers in the Vale are a bit like the big farmers in the Chilterns, if you like, and everybody else is struggling underneath them, you know, working for them.
Yes, that's interesting. When later, when sort of yeoman farmers, as it were, begins to appear, you were saying that class was more of a definer in a way, or became more important, and that these farmers looked for their peers and their colleagues outside the parish, in neighbouring parishes of the same type of status.
Yeah, and I think that's reflected in what they do with their homes, isn't it? The way they sort of set them back and so on. But they're not quite as inward looking as the gentry, of course, who have, you know, moated manorial sites and massive kind of farmyards in front of the street, so you can't actually get at the house.
Yeah.
But yeah, class matters a lot, even from quite early on, you know, that you like to have more outside, longer distance connections. You see that in the 13th century, with the way that sort of free tenants are named after the village, you know, John de Cooksum, for example, because his mates kind of operate in other villages and local towns. So that's how you identify him. If you're a little, you know, a pleb, as it were, living in the village, your peers are the other plebs in the village, and they call you, you know, John of the Well or whatever.
Yeah. Unless they know where you live.
Exactly.
Yes, interesting.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it does matter. And it's these big, you know, richer folk with larger holdings in the field that are more likely to be involved in sort of naming the landscape, I think. And you see that in the 15th century, in Cooksum again, the names of people that are put into the field are those of richer people. So there's a farmer who comes along. And farmer in this period, by the way, doesn't just mean the generic sense of farming the land, but it's someone who kind of hires a large area of land on a sort of commercial contract. So it's different from medieval peasants with a lord, really. The farmer there, that the name of this family only appears in the 15th century, and then it appears in the field. So we know it's a new kind of field name, if you like. And it's called Bell's Turning, Farmer Bell's Turning. So I don't know if it's where he turned his plough. But so it sometimes seems like it's earlier on as well. It's the more important people who get their names. Because, you know, what about women? What about children? They must have different perceptions. Yeah. But there's an anecdote of a poor woman. We know she was a poor cottager who throws a stone at the Lord's barn to the great damage of the Lord. You know, is she angry at this store of food that she hasn't got access to? You know, hunger in the belly changes the view of the landscape. And particularly, you know, in the early Middle Ages, this early shadowy period, like in the 6th, 7th century, people are all dead by 35. You know, they don't have, there's no grandparents floating around. Medieval peasants might live to 55. So that, again, that life cycle kind of thing affects, I think, how knowledge is passed on and people's perceptions. So yeah, class is one of the factors, a consistent kind of one, I think. But of course, it's the sort of other people probably had their views of landscape. They might have been a bit different, but we don't get to see it because they don't, you know, we can get at the sort of leading peasants better than we can get at the lesser people. They inhabit a different landscape, like the servants. They're in the fields on sufferance, aren't they, collecting someone else's crops, you know, on suspicion probably of stealing from somebody. And the servants who, you know, young people that you see in the church court depositions in the 16th, 17th century, they, you know, their sex lives are in the barn, or they you know, they have to hide in a coppice or something, whereas the kind of their employers who dominate this landscape, you know, their honour is protected in the bedroom, if you like, and they have a different view, different, they use the landscape in a different kind of way.
Yeah, so there is still this problem of finding the voices of all the people, because, yes, women and children, yes, must be very much harder.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you see it, they're kind of effaced from history in many ways. I'm sure we can, you know, we tried to get at them, and you can a bit. For instance, you know, widows, you see in tax lists, something as simple as that, the men are always named fully with a forename and an afternamed, but often it's like, you know, Widow Smith. Do the collectors don't even know the name, maybe. Yeah. So, yeah, although, of course, again, class, you know, rich women, they can run a whole holding once their husband's died, you know, as a widow, and they can be employing men and bossing men around to a degree. So I think it's the poor cottagers that are hard to get at. And they, you know, they live on the sort of spatial margins, if you like, too. Like in Cooksham, the cottagers, they live round the bend on the cold north side of the street, out of view of the church, you know, whereas the villeins live in a row next to the church.
Okay, so if it's not Vale and Chilton, just to come back to that, what was the unit that provided the focus?
Yeah, I mean, I think...
How does that change over time?
Well, as I said, it's not all territorial, so like family matters in every period. But of course, these people are much more tied to the land than us. You know, some people migrate, but especially before the Black Death, it's difficult to do so. You probably don't want to give up your 25 acres because, goodness me, what would you have then? You don't want to be like the sort of the only heretics in England that Henry I cast out in the 12th century to wander in the winter and then they die. Yeah. So, people stayed put. So I think family lineage kind of matters to peasants too, so that you, especially if you're the eldest son, so here it's an area of primogeniture and you inherit the holding and you take it on. But younger children might hope to get something too, and we see kind of homesteads being split up and other houses being built, which kind of changes the village plan and the social geography as well. They might hope to get something too. I think it's basically, you know, first and foremost, it's family and your bit of land. Then it's probably your village. Of course, some people live in hamlets, so that the hamlet. But by the late Middle Ages, the parish community matters a lot more, and people are getting, you know, involved in maintaining the church. In the 16th century, parish starts to take over local government and people start to govern the parish in a secular way as well, the leading people. But I think it's different here because we live in a, you know, Oxfordshire, or those that are in Oxfordshire live in a sort of artificial county, if you like. If you're from an ancient county with a strong identity like Yorkshire or something, you know, county identity might matter, especially at a higher kind of level. Some of these peasants, even free peasants, are going to the county court in Oxfordshire too, but there are not many signs that that matters, or the hundred, the unit that we studied was the hundred, this sort of now antiquated administrative unit. I think it's sort of village and then parish. I don't think manor, because of course manors, some manors were the same as a village, others sort of, there might be a village with four manors in it. I don't think manor mattered as much. You know, lords were people to be kind of suffered rather than loved on the whole.
Yes, that's very interesting, because I met a very nice lady in Seymour Green who's 85 and therefore had memories going back to the days of the Rutkeens and the Swinkham Manor. And the perception I got from her was that the manor was very important. And of course, the gentry, I assume, would say, well, of course, the manor is the most important thing, you know, because we're employing most people, especially in Swinkham, where there's little rural industry. But that's probably not right, is it? We've got better at seeing that there is a kind of, not exactly rebellion, but resistance to that top down.
Yeah.
Everything's about the country.
I mean, there is, I think, and people don't, you know, where, for instance, if they do migrate, they don't tend to migrate to the manor of their lord somewhere else. They go where there's a job, you know, near a town or something. I mean, you're right. It depends. There's this concept in English history, isn't there, of open and closed parishes, and certainly the closed ones where there's one landowner that dominates and his brother's the rector of the church or whatever. Their lords are, you know, have a big influence where they own all the houses or whatever. But in the Middle Ages, you've normally got sort of free tenants anyway in most places that are outside the scope of their kind of lordly meddling. And particularly where you've got three or four lords in a village or, you know, like the king, ironically, the king's a very weak lord locally because he's got other stuff to do. And lots of the manors like Benson and so on, they're royal. So people do their own thing, like the church in Warborough, which is next to Benson, is owned by the crown. The peasants seem to build their own church on the green because they want one. You know, they don't wait for the Lord to do it.
The Anglican vicar gets very cross that all these nonconformists insult all their Anglican congregation on a, Sunday morning. And yet, lordship must have had a major impact over peasants' lives and their perceptions.
It does. It does, especially at those key, I think, those key moments. Like, you know, in the early part of the period, you've got a great estate of Benson covering a vast area. We don't know how big, in which people just have to render honey and produce from time to time, particularly if they live near the centre. A lot of people are quite sort of free, if you like. Later on, you know, I mentioned that Cooksum Charter of the 10th century. That's when kings and other great lords are granting out little manors to littler lords who might well be local. And that's the period when these villages seem to coalesce and open fields are set out. And that's normally seen as a kind of lordly imposition, which to some extent it must have been. And that people have to kind of put their corralled into the village, aren't they? I mean, in the Anglo-Saxon period, even in the Vale, people lived in quite a scattered way. You see these sort of isolated homesteads that are swallowed up into the open fields and people are brought into the village. But then over time, people start to create their own space, I think, by, you know, rearranging where they live, the settlement plan, migrating and so on. And lords then, some of them are absent for long periods, like your Bec, you know, your Bec Abbey. How is that regulated from France? I suppose they've got local officials who do boss people around sometimes. But there's a lot of scope for villagers to sort of make their own social spaces and things, I think, you know, like, you know, the manor court. It's not just the place where the Lord bosses the peasants around, but it becomes their own forum, if you like, for regulating their own affairs to some extent.
Yeah.
I mean, this is all a bit controversial. Historians used to see lords as some of them still do, the ultimate kind of movers and shakers of everything, not just in politics, but in economy, local landscape. I think that's a bit too much, you know, that we shouldn't see these peasants as kind of passive pawns, that they do have, the trendy term is agency, isn't it? That they have their own kind of agency and they decide on stuff.
And I suppose one of the things that affects them particularly is the increasing enclosure, or maybe more in the Vale than in the Chilterns, but nonetheless, which obviously gathers space, as we mentioned, from the 16th century. What are the impacts within this area?
They can be extreme. So there's a little place called Warp's Grove, which is next to Chalgrove. It's a bit of a wretched clay kind of little couple of fields, really. It was one of the smallest parishes in Oxfordshire. It's about 335 acres or something. But, you know, in the 13th century, it's got its own church. It's an independent parish. It has a rector. It's got a little village, a little clustered village. In the 15th century, it's probably already declined, thanks to the Black Death. But it seems like the lords or the lessees, the Stoners, a big local family, enclose it. And that means they kind of chuck out the remaining agriculturalists and they just turn it all to pasture for their sheep. So there's no more open field. The church is abandoned and we found it by geophysics, you know, that technique of recovering underground structures. And you can see it in the sort of the geophysical plan that we made. And it turns into a place where apparently in the 16th century, there's a single shepherd that visits and nobody lives there at all. So it can have a massive impact.
Yeah.
And no one comes back to Warp's Grove until the 18th century, when a couple of farmhouses are built there. Elsewhere, it's a bit you know, it varies. The small little vale places are, some of them are enclosed or partly enclosed, maybe by leading farmers as well as lords. The Chilterns already is enclosed, of course, largely from much earlier period. But where it happens, a few people can be driven out of their homes or maybe bought out, and little settlements can disappear. And people must have had to get used to seeing ruined houses and so on. But I guess to some extent, maybe that's been overdone. You know, the sort of, again, lords enclose and drive people out. Plenty of villages survive and they shrink a bit, largely because of population decline, not because of lords doing anything. And lords can be very keen to retain tenants who pay rents after all. It matters. And those landscapes then have to be kind of renamed, I suppose, don't they? And rethought about, because they're not open field, arable, shared landscapes. They're just big enclosed fields.
And I suppose over the period also, houses and living spaces must have changed an awful lot. How did they change generally? I know it's quite a big question. And how did they reflect peasants' changing perceptions?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I mentioned there is a bit of a divide between people and landscape. I think there is a perception of the family, the individuals, as being separate. You see that in the Anglo-Saxon period with these houses which are very impermanent, you know, have to be rebuilt very frequently, but were spaces nonetheless that people invested in, where they presumably told stories by the fireside about the monsters that live in the woods, Beowulf and Grendel stuff. By the sort of high Middle Ages, by which I mean the 12th, 13th century after the conquest, peasant houses are pretty substantial, and they're often built by professional craftsmen. They're not kind of wretched hovels. They might look a bit like that to us. They are smoky, dark, but they're made, you know, a kind of an average peasant house of the 14th century is probably made from more than 100 trees. So it's a big job. And they vary by class again. I think the wealthier peasants have a bit, almost on a tiny scale, a bit like a lord's manor house, where there's a hall and a raised dais where the head of the household would sit and the servants would sit below. And there's a bit of performative element. You can see their little structures of, you know, 30 feet long or 40 feet long, but there's a little hall and they use tablecloths and they use napkins and bowls to wash their hands at meals. And probably they had one or two bits of furniture. There's one wonderful inventory of the Reeves possessions at Cooksham and another peasant's at the Black Death. So the Lord actually takes an inventory of what they owned, having died of the plague. And you see one of these guys, he owns one chair. And I'm guessing if you look later kind of anthropological examples of, you know, like Welsh farmhouses in the 18th century or Brittany or whatever, it's the husband, if there is one, isn't it? He's the kind of lord of the house. He sits in the one chair.
Yeah, he's got the chair.
So they're kind of, some of them are big enough to be semi-public spaces. They might invite people in to witness an important agreement about land or a wedding or something. But they're still tiny houses even later of the poor, and they're poorly enclosed on the edge of the common. They're less private, if you like, aren't they? They can't probably keep sort of sheep out, let alone people. There's wretched sort of hovels on the edge of the common that are one, you know, there's houses described in the 17th century that are 12 feet by 16 feet.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, so they're, but, and again, you know, the kind of hierarchy is getting steeper, because by that period, the rich are building houses with two floors. From having open halls, smoky open halls, they're putting in ceilings and having an upstairs. You go up to bed and you have a chimney piece that takes the smoke out, so you don't have to have an open hall. And they have areas for servants. Some of the wills, the inventories from wills, show that they have a servant's chamber that's separated from the master and the mistress of the house. And there's more of a sort of gendering, where the kitchen becomes a female and a sort of servant space.
So this is what Hoskins called the great rebuilding.
It recurs over a very long period. And you see, one of the things we did was dendrochronology, or tree ring dating, to try and get precise dates of some of these houses. And we were able to do that and see how, you know, particular house in Warborough, for instance, dated to the late 16th century. And they'd built these two little stubby wings pointing at the street. It seems to sort of show off their fine timbers. Or you might put a big chimney, a massive, there's one in Benson that's been dated to the 17th century, a massive chimney is right on the road, you know, so no one can fail to see how warm you must be inside.
It's good. I had no idea that a chimney could be a status symbol.
Yeah, I think it must have been thinking the man hours to make it and the resources. Yeah.
What haven't I asked you, Stephen, that I should have asked you?
Well, I mean, one thing I was going to say, I suppose, was that we talked a bit about field names and what they can show you. Just people might be surprised at some of the names from the Middle Ages that show us a sense of the past, really, that there were other people that used to live in this landscape. So, you know, there are names like Le Ruin in Benson Open Fields. The Old Fort in Swinkham. There are saints' names, like Barinus is the local saint, that are sort of fields that are called Barinus's Field or Barinus's Hill. And we know these, you know, they sort of get a sense of history piling up, like in New Elm, there's a field name about the Burr. It seems to relate to an Anglo-Saxon site that was there. There's also a hidden stone, or something called the Hidden Stone, which is next to the Burr site. So you seem to have kind of layers of meaning and probably like local stories developing. Like with the example of Verinus, this saint, this 7th century saint of the local bishop as well of Dorchester, there's a, if you were ever to climb the tower of Dorchester Church, with permission, there's inside that there's a massive 14th century bell, which is it inscribed, you know, Verinus protect all those that I call. And out in the landscape, the peasants have named this Verinus's Field. So we can't always the full stories behind it, but we can see a meaningful landscape, not just a pragmatic landscape. And I think that's one of the most exciting things to have emerged from the project.
That was one of the things, if I remember rightly, that there was a ridge called Victory Ridge or some sort of vague old memory of some conflict that must have happened way in the past and was still there written in the landscape centuries later.
That's right. And I suppose the meanings of these things must change. They must become garbled or not meaning anything, but potentially. But they are there. You know, there's a 10th century tenant who's remembered in the 14th century, which is extraordinary.
And that must mean something. I mean, even if you don't understand it, there is still that imprint of the past and previous generations. So, you know, we look at our Olderby, our, you know, our little fort here, and everybody wonders about what it is and what it means and what it was. And everybody's got their theory. But it's a connection between us and possibly the Romans. They're at Swinkham Down. There's an old entrenchment. Some people call it the Danish entrenchment. And I think one of the other stories I loved particularly in your book was the thing about the settlement at Wyfold, which looks as though it might have had some religious connotation at a time when people travelled up from the Vale.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a kind of popular memory, isn't there? I mean, I think documents start to matter more and more and names are written down. But for peasants, popular memory matters. And it doesn't matter if they don't understand sort of real historical origins, I guess. It's about, it makes these places kind of our place, doesn't it? You know, there's a load of people at one settlement who are called, their by name is Of the Castle, because they live next to the castle, you know. So that must, there's a very localized identity that does matter. It's not all, some of it's about stamping ownership, you know, Fred Bloggs's field or whatever, or understanding the soil, you know, the gravelly field or whatever. But some of it's about, you know, there's a holy well in Brightwell Baldwin. But some of it's religious, some of it's about a sense of past people that probably, as you say, speaks to us as well today, doesn't it?
Well, it's an interesting question we could get into of what is history and what matters about history. That it seems to me that the scientific approach to history, of course, we all believe in it and it's right, you're looking for truth. But there is that old tradition of telling stories and telling stories about the past, which has meaning in the present and is not necessarily accurate. And does that matter?
Yeah, I mean, I think also that some of this kind of stuff about perceptions has been seen a bit flaky, particularly where people just kind of build an Iron Age roundhouse and sit and look out and imagine what it would have been like. But this is tied to those real examples, the documented examples of names. And I think the names are used by the people at the time for storytelling, for social, you know, cohesion, and that matters. But but also for social capital, if you like. I think it's those who are, you know, shape the stories of the place become even more powerful, don't they? So I think, and because peasants matter, you know, they are the ones that labored to create these vast open fields. They their decisions shaped the economy of the Middle Ages and their labor. So I think that that kind of culture of the peasantry matters too, if we're going to understand the Middle Ages and on its own terms rather than just seeing it as some sort of precursor to the modern world.
I mean, without getting over emotional about it, it's also about understanding what what is valuable. Understanding these big movements and so on is valuable, but also understanding what matters to individuals and giving people's lives in a community meaning is also more important. Anyway, so Stephen, thank you very much. That was a fantastic discussion. I absolutely loved it.
Pleasure.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Stephen, thanks for having me on.
Lovely to talk to you. And yes, thank you very much.
Thanks.
I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did, everyone. The title of the book, again, is Peasant Perceptions of Landscape, South Oxfordshire, 500 to 1650, and it's by Stephen Mileson and Stuart Brooks. It's available to buy or order right now. It's from OUP, or you can buy it from any good bookshop, I assume. And I'll put a link on the post for this episode on the website, thehistoryofengland.co.uk, if you want to hop along there. Okay, thanks very much for listening, everyone. Good luck and have a great week.